Great. So, yeah, I've really enjoyed this week, and the lectures were wonderful. This is a talk directly about local Hamiltonian, not really about representability, although, as Yikai was saying, these two problems are in some sense equivalent. It's joint work done with Stephen Jordan, who's a postdoc at IQI, and that's the QuantPH reference. The version of this result I'm going to give you is a slightly simplified presentation. It's actually a remarkably simple result, and it's so simple that I thought I should try and give you as much detail as possible. Let me begin in the same place as the last two talks and think about two questions that I get quite excited about. The first one, obviously, is of great relevance to things we've been talking about this week. How hard is it to simulate quantum mechanics, either classically or quantum, or using a quantum computer, which Alain Aspery will talk about tomorrow? And we could ask questions about what we've been thinking about today, which is computing energy eigenvalues or simulating time evolution. There's a related question that I won't talk very much about, I'll just sort of point out as we go by it, which is how hard is it to build a universal quantum computer realized adiabatically? And some of these questions are related to these questions about which Hamiltonians have ground state problems, which are QMA complete. So these questions are how complex do the Hamiltonians have to be? Complexity like pornography, you know it when you see it, so let's be more precise. So how many different types of coupling strengths do you need? How many different values? And how do these coupling strengths scale? I don't think anyone's talked about adiabatic quantum computing yet, so let me just say what it is. This is an idea originally due to Fahy, Goldstone, Gutmann, and Sipser, where you simply start with some very simple Hamiltonian for which you know that the system will reach its ground state trivially, like maybe it's just got one local biases. Then you switch on some very complicated Hamiltonian, which the ground state to which encodes the solution to some kind of problem. And if you do this slowly enough, where slowly enough is defined spectrally, and if you want to understand that, you should read Mary Best's paper about the adiabatic theorem applied in quantum information, you will wind up in the ground state of this final problem. Now, originally, this was applied to problems whose ground states encoded the solution to NP-complete problems, and then there's a debate about why that can't possibly work. But now we know how to do this so that you can map any quantum computation into this model. So this is an alternate model of quantum computation that's appealing sort of technologically because this kind of slow adiabatic control may be easier to do in the lab. Okay, so this is just what Yikai was saying. I want to talk about these things in a sort of colloquial way. So when I say something's easy, this has a complexity theoretic meaning, this phrase, that these are things believed by wide circles and narrow specialists but not actually known, is due to Kitaev, Shen, and Vialyu's book, and I just thought that was the most wonderfully pleasant way of saying it. And so what would be wonderful to have, you know, this is just to say a research problem, it would be wonderful to know that there's a class of physical systems such that simulating them on a quantum computer is BQP complete. This is bounded quantum polynomial, not Boolean quadratic thingy-bob. It'd be wonderful to know that there was a class of problems that you could do on a quantum computer that were problems in physics or chemistry that somehow captured all the hardness of things that quantum computers are good at. Obviously, we'd love to know which ones you can do on a classical computer. We'd love to know which ones you can't really do on a quantum computer. And it's that final question that this talk is really about. Okay, so there's the definition of quantum Merlin-Arthur games, QMA. I realized that this talk would be at 4:30, so I thought you might like a cartoon. So what's the story that underlies this rather formal definition? Well, of course, Arthur and Merlin live in England in the dim and magical past when all of the monarchy had a quantum computer. But like all monarchs, they're beset by problems. These are eigenvalue problems, of course. Fortunately, the monarch has access to a magician, Merlin, who's a quantum magician, and like all magicians, you don't trust them. So when you ask them a question, you don't believe them, you ask them to give you evidence. And in this case, Merlin gives you a witness state. What do? You feed that into your quantum computer, and then you can verify whether or not the answer to the question that you're asking is right. So the key point here is Merlin is somewhat devious, so he's going to try and deceive you. But the extent to which he's allowed to deceive you, the extent to which he's allowed for your check to answer yes when the answer is really no, are strictly bounded. Okay? So it's non-deterministic, but he's not allowed to be arbitrarily nasty. And as we said in the last talk, you can actually amplify. It's not obvious that you can amplify your probability of getting the right answer by asking him again, because if he's giving you a sequence of quantum states, he might be able to entangle them. But it's some work that's in Kitaj Chen and Vialli's book that he can't really hurt you by doing that. So there's some input that corresponds to some witness state that corresponds to a yes answer, and then there's not any witness state that can mislead you about a no answer. Okay, so it's always easier for me at least to think about a problem rather than a class, so what's the complete problem? And here's the local Hamiltonian problem. In this case, we have some function, the yes instances correspond to this case, that here's the spectrum of H. The lowest eigenvalue of H, which in this literature is called lambda of H, lies below some bound A for a yes instance, or above some bound B for a no instance. And these two bounds are separated by something called the promise gap, which must not be exponentially small. Okay, so this is, in a decision sense, equivalent to finding the ground state energy of a Hamiltonian, something we'd love to be able to do generally. Okay, so how do we know local Hamiltonians in QMA? Well, if you have a yes instance, this is a rather physicist-y proof, but you could say, well, he can hand me an energy eigenstate, he can hand me the quantum state, which corresponds to the ground state, and then I can just measure the energy on that state. And in this context, measuring the energy can be suitably formalized, meaning run a phase estimation algorithm on a quantum computer, so you can turn it into a statement about measuring observables that you can really believe are easy to measure, like individual bits. And so then all Merlin has to do is actually give me an eigenstate that has a sufficiently large overlap with the ground state, and that will give me a reasonable probability of getting a yes for a yes answer. For a yes instance. And for a no instance, there's no state he can give me that will result in an energy measurement less than A. I just measure the energy, I'm going to keep getting I'm going to keep sampling from the energy eigenvalues, so there's no way he can fool me as long as I just keep measuring the energy. So that's, of course, it's always easier to put problems into a class than to prove that the problem is complete for that class. So in order to go the other direction, I have to say that somehow this decision problem on a Hamiltonian is as hard as every possible problem in QMA. That means that it sort of spans this whole space of possible verifiers. So whatever the verifier is that I use, I have to somehow be able to encode the fact that that verifier either outputs yes or no into a statement about the energy eigenvalues of a Hamiltonian. So now I need a map that does the following thing. I need a map that takes a unitary matrix, which implements my verifier, which could be anything, and maps it into a Hamiltonian, such that if the verifier says yes, then the Hamiltonian has a low eigenvalue. If the verifier says no, then the Hamiltonian has a high eigenvalue. Okay, so how do we do that? Well, this is a construction that's from Feynman via Kitaev. And what we do is we take the complete time evolution of that circuit. So a quantum circuit is a sequence of unitary operators applied one after the other, such that each individual unitary operator acts non-trivially only on a subset of qubits, so usually two or one. So you have a sequence of unitaries in the circuit, and we map that in of length p, and we map that into a superposition over all t. And if you prepare this superposition and measure it, you will sample states in the evolution. You can amplify your probability of getting the last one by just appending a whole bunch of identities to the end of the circuit. So 50% of your superposition is the last state in the circuit that you want to look at. Okay, so what's T? T is some state of a set of ancilla qubits that fulfills the role of a clock. A typical clock has a Hamiltonian given by this, so it's a sequence of bits such that clock states are 1111100000. So a nice physical way of thinking about that is it's a set of spins coupled ferromagnetically, and then you put twisted boundary on them. So the ground state of that system is spanned by all the states with just one domain wall. And then the position of that domain wall is the time. And then you advance your clock by sort of pushing that domain wall along one. So by constructing a Hamiltonian that has this ground state, which is actually rather straightforward, you can take a unitary, construct a Hamiltonian. You have to mess around with a clock operator. You have to have something that sets the initial state to be right, and you have to have something that makes sure that you penalize or reward the correct circuit output. That formula gives you the construction that Kutev used, which shows that 5 local Hamiltonian is QMA complete. Then that was improved by Kempe and Regev, and also then subsequently by Moses and Nagai to show that 3 local is QMA complete, then 2 local, then 2 local, where local really means physically local, i.e. next to each other. And then Jake Diamanti, who's now at the Computer Science Department in Oxford, showed that you could restrict this further, so you could actually restrict the types of coupling. So here, I'm not going to use sigma x, which everyone else has been using. I'm going to use capital X. And this just means, in the computational basis, it's just that matrix. And y and z are sigma y and sigma z. Okay, so what do we do in this work? Well, we sort of push this chain of reductions even further and say if you restrict your matrix to now be a Markov matrix, then the problem stays QMA complete. So this result has a funny history. Stephen and I were actually thinking about how to get around a problem that occurs for superconducting qubits that you manipulate adiabatically. And we were trying to use perturbation theory to get around the fact that the Hamiltonians of these things are stochastic. But because of a complexity result by Bravieu, we knew that we wouldn't be able to do this. But we wanted to try anyway and see where we fell on our faces. And then from there, the project sort of wandered around and ended up where it is now. Okay, so what's a Markov matrix? I want to be economical with time, so let me just say we're only interested here in symmetric Markov matrices, which are the transition probabilities for random walks on undirected graphs with self loops. So I have some states. So the probability to go from I to J is the same as the probability to go from J to I. And the probability to stay at I is something, and the probability to stay at J is something. And so you put weights on these edges of this graph, and these are the diagonal entries of the matrix, the I diagonal entry and the J diagonal entry, and this is the IJ from the JI entry of the matrix. And the rows and the columns have to sum to 1. Every Markov matrix has a spectrum that's bounded between minus 1 and 1. It always has a 1 eigenstate, which is the equilibrium state of the chain. And in practical applications, what you're doing is running the chain, applying this matrix many times until the thing converges to that state. So it's a sort of sampling method. So what you want to know, the questions that are interesting about Markov chains are, how fast does that happen? How fast do you reach equilibrium? And so recently there has been all this remarkable work about random walks on expander graphs that converge extremely rapidly and therefore have applications in de-randomization, so replacing random numbers in algorithms with a deterministic, in this case a Markov chain or a random walk. Okay, so in this case, symmetric chains have one property, which is simply that the equilibrium state is the uniform distribution over the states of the chain. Okay, and what's a stochastic matrix? Well, a stochastic matrix is stochastic with respect to basis B if all the off-diagonal elements of the Hamiltonian in that basis are non-positive. Okay, so here's an example. It's a little x bias and an xx coupling on two qubits, and with these d, the d and k are is positive, so all the off-diagonal elements are negative. Hey presto, that's a stochastic matrix. You can see Sergei Bravier is responsible for improving the elocution of everyone in quantum information by getting them to say stochastic and distinguish that from stochastic. And why are these interesting? It's because they're very common in physical systems, both in physical systems that you're interested in condensed matter, and but also as a sort of pain in the backside, if you're trying to build a quantum computer, you quite often end up, oh no, I have these wonderful things in the lab, except the Hamiltonian stochastic. I don't have full enough control to make the off-diagonal matrix elements both positive and negative. And also, from a complexity theory point of view, Bravier, or this local Hamiltonian problem, is known to lie in classical complexity classes. Okay, so how do we generate a QMA completeness problem for this, or a QMA complete problem? So this is our starting point. This is the one of the Hamiltonians that Jake and I wrote down. I should say, just to give credit where it's due, that Dave Bacon actually had this result contemporaneously with us and independently. We sort of talked to him, but he didn't write it up for some reason. I think he got married. So I got married the following year, so I guess that accounts for that part of the literature. So what do we do? Well, Dominic Yunzing and Pavel Vulchan use this trick in a different context. So all we do is we take the elements 1 and minus 1 and we replace them by 2 by 2 matrices, and the element 0 and replace it by a 4 by 4 matrix. The first time we did this, we obviously used perturbation theory because that's what you do when you're working with QMA, but subsequently realized you don't need to do that. If you think about taking the entire matrix of the Hamiltonian on a given basis, and trying to write down sort of algebraically what that replacement operation is, well, what it means is you're taking all the positive elements of the matrix and then taking the tensor product with the identity on a low qubit, on a low ancilla qubit. And then you're taking all the negative entries in the matrix and taking the tensor product with a sigma x on the low qubit. So that if you take the element-wise magnitude of the matrix, which is this H prime thing, then this construction tells you exactly what the twice as large matrix is with this replacement applied. And then just some trivial algebra tells you that this gives you the element-wise magnitude tensored with a projector onto the low qubit in the state plus, in the plus one eigenstate of the sigma x operator, plus the original matrix tensor product the projector into the minus eigenstate. And now this is the bit that I sort of, there's an issue here that I'm eliding for the case for simplicity. Really what you should do is do this one term at a time. Okay? If you do it one term at a time, you get a slightly different Hamiltonian here, and it means that when you normalize the Hamiltonian, you don't run into issues with trying to add up a row sum that includes an exponentially large number of elements. I then normalize this by the sum of them, by the row sum, and off we go. So now this thing is a Markov matrix. Okay, so we don't quite want that, because the spectra of these two, of this element-wise thing and the original matrix, yep. Oh, thanks. Yeah, this won't take more than 5 minutes. The spectra of these two matrices, of course, might overlap. And so what we can easily do is apply a penalty that will to the ancilla, which penalizes moving out of this minus subspace. So we can guarantee that the spectrum of the original Hamiltonian gets shifted and scaled to be the low-lying sector of the Markov chain. And similarly, the spectrum of this new funny Hamiltonian H prime gets shifted and scaled up. Okay? So now, what we've done is construct a Markov chain such that answering questions about this lowest eigenvalue is equivalently hard to answering questions about the lowest eigenvalue of the original Hamiltonian. Therefore, answering questions about this set of Markov chains so constructed is QMA complete. Remember, we can start with a U, we can start with any problem in QMA, map it to a Hamiltonian, map the Hamiltonian to a Markov chain. Hey presto, we've got a Markov chain for every problem in QMA. But also minus HP is a stochastic Hamiltonian. So answering questions about the highest eigenstate of the stochastic Hamiltonian is also equivalently hard. So those are basically the two new results. Okay, so why would we care? So finding eigenstates of eigenvalues of Markov matrices is in some sense, a totally classical problem. So it's sort of cute, I wouldn't want to say it's more than that, that we have a classical problem which is QMA complete. What one would like to say is to make a stronger statement, because the mixing time of Markov chains is not actually the minimum of these two things, but it's effectively determined by either the second largest eigenvalue, the one that isn't one but the next one down, or if the lowest lying eigenvalue is negative, then if the magnitude of the lowest lying negative eigenvalue is larger than that one, then it's determined by magnitude of lambda n. So in some, but we don't know that, right? We haven't shown that there always exists a Markov chain such that this lowest eigenvalue, which is hard to determine, dominates the mixing time. We don't know that yet. And in fact, in practical applications, you can always turn up all the self-loop weights, increase the probability that the walk stays where it is, so that all the eigenvalues are greater than zero. And then the final result is just that finding the highest eigenvalue of stochastic matrices is hard, which sort of formally confirms something we sort of knew intuitively, which is the lowest, if you look at the amplitudes in the ground state of a stochastic matrix, they're all positive. So somehow that makes it morally equivalent to a probability distribution. But that's not going to, so therefore you expect, in some sense, classical algorithms to determine that distribution to be findable. But that's not going to be true for the higher lying states. So there's no reason to suppose that higher lying states in the spectrum are going to be easy to find. And so here we should just show that you can sort of formalize that in this sense. Okay, that's it.